37 years, staying vigilant as always. 94.1 FM, KPFA.
Options Recovery Services invites you to our 20th anniversary gala, Roaring Into Our 20s, hosted by honorary board member and longtime supporter Martin Sheen. The benefit takes place Saturday, May 20th, 5 to 9 p.m. at UC Berkeley's International House, 2294 Piedmont Avenue at the top of Bancroft. The event is wheelchair accessible and it's a benefit for Options Recovery Services, which provides intensive drug and alcohol treatment to homeless and low-income Berkeley residents, regardless of their ability to pay. For more information, please call 510-599-4950. That's 510-599-4950.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is a minute past 2 p.m. Up next, the Visionary Activist Show.
To the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, coming to you from the Coyote Witchery just upriver from Washington, D.C., weaving the fabric of kinship, you know, for the last 20 years between Washington, D.C. and California and all the beings globally, literally and symbolically. Here we are at True Beltane, which will be tonight, a few minutes past midnight. It is one of the four gates of power. It is the festival of Venusian animism unfurling before us, that humans may rejoin the choreography of creation. And we say some things are always true, but there are times when they are truer. And we say now the protoplasm of reality is especially receptive to imaginative imprint. So not only is it True Beltane, Mercury Hermes is stationing right now, conjoining Uranus, which is the principle of nature's evolutionary ingenious trickster intelligence. You know, they will be exact forward on Buddha's full moon birthday, when the Buddha attained enlightenment with his back against the Bodhi tree, because no one attains enlightenment without nature. So, more than perfectly, we welcome Michael Mead, and the Sky Astrological Story also is welcoming him very much, because the image, there are images for each degree of the zodiac, so the image for the sun right now is a stranger walks into town in the midst of a wild windstorm, wearing a silk top hat and carrying a large black bag. Excuse me, the doctor magician, controller of hidden natural forces, testing the effectiveness of newfound potentials, maintaining a strong instinctual connection to nature and its forces, despite all external sophistication. Divination, how wonderful. So, many of us know Michael Mead, renowned storyteller, author, scholar of mythology, anthropology, psychology. I think of him as a fellow mytho-guide and fellow word maven. He has an unusual ability to distill and synthesize these disciplines, tapping into ancestral sources of wisdom, connecting them to the stories we're living today. He is inspirationally prolific, the author of The Genius Myth, Fate and Destiny, The Two Agreements of the Soul, Why the World Doesn't End, The Water of Life, Initiation and the Tempering of the Soul, editor with two of my buddies, ancestor James Hillman and Robert Bly of Rag and Bone Shop of the Heart, editor of Crossroads, A Quest for Contemporary Rites of Passage. He's the founder of Mosaic Multicultural Foundation, a nonprofit network of artists, activists, and community builders that encourages greater understanding between diverse peoples. Welcome, Michael.
Well, good to be with you on Beltane, Caroline.
Exactly. So it is one of the four gates of power, and as we spoke a little bit backstage, it's where dedicated acts of beauty invite power into the world, that the invisible, the darkness, is especially eager to commune with the onstage world of sensual, incarnational fur and mangoes and everything. So that's perfect, right?
Yeah, although it's ironic now, right? Because people used to gather on Beltane to reconnect to nature, specifically to connect to the intermediaries, the spirits and the little people, and to ask for protection in the form of good health for the people, for their herds, for their crops. And so here we are on that day of asking for health, and just hours ago the House of Representatives dropped their new health care bill, which of course has neither health nor care in it. So we may have to rely on all the unseen forces, because those in power are determined to deny health to people, in a sense.
Right, those in control. Yes, absolutely. No, I love that Dorothy Parker used to answer her phone by saying, "What fresh hell is this?" And so that's a useful way for all of us going, "Oh, my God." But in perusing your many prolific works, and we also want to make people aware of your upcoming Mill Valley events on May 11th and also, I think, May 12th that we will honor. But listening to your podcasts are great, but the most recent one, Consideration of the Soul, and again, bonus points, because disaster means, against the soul, against the stars, and consider is with the stars, so we avert disaster by gathering to consider, there we go, so considering of the souls, and you were speaking about your morning practice, which is so pertinent to us, knowledge within, waiting to awaken. That's, again, some things are always true, but times when they are truer, even more true now. And then maybe you could guide us to angels. I love your take on angels. They're not chubby cherubim. They're more like, do you know the wonderful movie Wings of Desire?
Yeah,
German angels. That's what we want. Substantial angels, not new age fluffy things. But I love what you say about angels, and since it is about to be the Buddha's full moon next week, with his attaining enlightenment, with his back pressed against the tree, maybe you could guide us into the angels and the soul at the tree of life.
Oh, wonderful, yeah. Well, the angels fit right in with the little people and the fairies and the spirits. They were one of the versions of that found in all cultures, including Buddhism, Hinduism, and as well as Judeo-Christian tradition. But they weren't, the little cherubs, like you said. They were powerful spirits and emerging spirits constantly. And so in an old Jewish, what I call a folk myth, it says that each soul is born from the roots of the tree of life, which would later on become the tree upon which Buddha leans, and is lifted into the branches as it ripens by the angel Gabriel, but then handed over to the angel Layla, whose name means night or darkness, the angels who is the daughter of night. And she then puts that soul born from the roots of the tree of life into the womb of the expectant mother, and after putting it in there, puts a candle at the head of that person to be, and lights that candle. And then the story says that by the light of that candle burning in the darkness of the inner womb, the soul sees the world outside and sees its place in it. And that idea to me is profound. In other words, you don't have to go looking for a world view. Everyone is born with a world view. And Allah Buddha, who was born to wealthy people, but had to see poverty, death, and illness on the way to awakening to what was already inside him, we are all, know it or not, on a Buddha path, trying to awaken to that which was inside us from before we were born.
No, it's so perfect, and because I have the guiding, you know, earth sky story of now, and as we convene right now in Berkeley, 2+ Virgos rising, whose symbol is a guardian angel, watches over a couple in the wilderness. So it's like there is a call and response, and as you say, you know, the world, we go no, without magic we're doomed, you know, but with magic, meaning a willingness to cooperate with everything that is so generously proffered, that's the evolutionary assist. And you remind us that angel meant messenger or errand spirit. Yeah,
the angel was one of the go-betweens, which ancients used to refer to the intermediaries. So you have the mundane world, or the practical world, the factual, measurable world, and then you have the world of the eternal. And people used to imagine that there were things that connected those two. Now we've fallen into the subject-object division with nothing in between, which then becomes the Republican-Democrat division or the conservative-liberal division. We're caught in all those divisions. And you could say one of the reasons is we lost the intermediaries, the angels, the spirits, the trees themselves, the bees and those little birds that are now singing songs somewhere. If we slow down enough, we can catch those messages coming from what we call nature. But in West Africa, they say nature and spirit are the same thing, and they're both trying to talk to us and offer guidance in a world that seems to be becoming more divided all the time.
Yeah. And also, just again, as we've said, you know, some genius is scheduling us. Again, the perfectness of you being here right now. And then, just for the fun of it, you know, when you were born, the sun is at 25 Capricorn. When I was born, 25 plus Capricorn was rising. And the image for that is nature spirits dancing in the mist of a waterfall, and we go, ooh, and it's the degree of pragmatic mysticism. There we go, teasing knowledge into practical application, which is, you know, so great. But you also say the angel of knowledge, you know, Layla, darkness, that wisdom is dark knowledge, light hidden in the darkness, yeah?
Yeah, the soul, one description of the soul used to be the light hidden in darkness. So when you say these are dark times, you can quickly get the equation, better look for the soul, because the soul is the light hidden in that darkness. And then there's also the sense that anything that is unknown is in darkness, and we have to go there to find it. And so there's a way in which the soul has a courage for drawing life out of things that seem lifeless, for drawing beauty out of things that seem conflicted, and from drawing the eternal out of stuck times. And so, by all measures, I think, we're living in the hard times, we're living in the dark times, the Kali Yuga, if we want to call it that. And that's the time to look for soul. And then they used to say, hidden inside the soul is the seed of genius, which is the unique angel of one's life waiting to awaken. So then you go to the idea that says, in times of difficulty, there's an acceleration of calling. And what's calling is the genius hidden within each person.
Perfect. Right. No, because it is right now also the festival of call and response, that that humans may re-enter the choreography of creation. And, you know, you mentioned a lot the eternal and the actual, this riptide, you know, ancient into modern, inner into outer. And of course, the cross precedes Christianity. It's the vertical axis is the spirit world, and the horizontal is the material world, and where they meet within all of us, right, is that dynamic, and that commerce. And you know, I like, you know, you we can head forth into your wonderful work on genius, which is parallel and kin to my dedication to what I call, you know, trickster. It's really the same thing, the long before humans, there was Trickster who sets the whole shebang going with a sizzle of lightning, and it, you know, that sizzle of, you know, ingenuity and uniqueness, and every now and then gets confined by orthodoxy, but it learns how to escape. There you go, and it goes into each one of us awakening, you know, awaiting the call. And that's also kind of what you're saying about, you know, the angel Gabriel, the conception that regardless of our temporary age, race, and gender assignment right now, this is a fertilizing or quickening time, right? You know, for our own genius, our access to our own unique genius, which connects us to collective genius. Does that feel right to you?
Totally. I mean, now requires that our unique genius awaken. So I write this book, The Genius Myth, in order to try and suggest a change of course. I mean, in popular American life, the only really mythic story that has had any traction is the hero's journey, I would say. And yet the hero tends to be a little masculine, a little focused on the outer world and finding boons out there, and a little muscular, maybe a little bit tending to dominate. And so, and then you get the sense, well, there are some people can be heroic and others just won't. But genius, which really means the spirit that's already in a person before they're born, that's the original meaning of genius, suggests that everybody already has genius, their unique genius. Everybody is a genius trying to awaken, and it doesn't matter, like you said, the issues of age or class or gender or race or social status. None of that matters as much as awakening to the genius qualities, trying to find their way into life through each one of us. So I think, although the hero story is a great story, it may be time to move on to the genius myth, which invites everybody to awaken and everybody to contribute. And given all the problems we have, I think everybody needs to contribute.
Right. And you know, the way I've been kind of working it is the trickster redeemer that is found, you know, among men, women, everything, animals, all of that. And it's the it's, you know, like Scheherazade, the power of the woman storyteller within everybody, regardless of gender assignment, who's interested in saving women, saving the land, but willing, not counting on, but willing to liberate even the tyrant who has hardened their heart. You know, and the southern corollary is High John the Conqueror, wonderful essay by Zora Neale Hurston, High John, because High John, whom Obama quoted, he finds a way out of no way and hits a straight lick with a crooked stick, and is interested in solace and comfort, but liberating even the slaveholder, again, not counting on it. So this dance of Mars and Venus, right, the hero's journey, and yeah, I did have the great delight of studying Grail Legend with Joseph Campbell, and then cahooting with Hillman a fair amount, you know. But I think where kind of, let me run this by you, where Hillman might be kind of handing the baton to yourself and the likes of ourselves and whoever, you know, inwardly resonates, is part of my conversation with him is, he would say, you can study ritual, but to actually do ritual is inflation. I'm like, oh, James, come on. You know, and I think that the so many of our mentors, Joseph Campbell, James Hillman, they did an exemplary job of what it is to be an educated person. But there was still a little bit of academic restraint about doing the magic. Does that amuse you?
Yes, it does. It's quite accurate. I love James, and we had, you know, amazing adventures together on the roads of learning and humor and everything. But I remember on his 70th birthday, there was a large gathering of people, and people were giving toasts, and he said, "Well, Michael, to give the last toast," and then he said to me privately, "But no ritual," and he literally said it, and so. So when it right. came to give the toast, I said, well, I can only give a toast of the kind that I wish to give to someone who is an elder, And I think James has become an elder, but you can't become truly an elder till everybody acknowledges you're an elder. And so I really think I require everybody to sing to him as if he was our elder. And in order to do that, everybody has to understand the song, and everybody has to learn to sing it. And so I taught everybody a West African song, and everyone stood in this fancy ballroom kind of thing and sang this African song that they sing, calling out the elder and people. And James, you know, tried to turn his head and then broke into a smile and bowed his head and said, okay, I'll become the elder.
That's
so sometimes
great.
Sometimes you
That's
have
great.
To trick the elder to be the elder.
Well, especially both Joseph Campbell and James Hillman were Aries, which is the incarnation of Mars, the hero guy, you know. But they need teasing. They need Venus to flirt and tease with them to be worshipped as relic. No, and just a little bit. That's your example, and we're kinned in that way. He was a perfectly splendid astrologer, and we met that way. But at a Cycles and Symbols conference in the Bay Area, I did a astrology lecture, and then at the end I said, you know, in the Negredo, which is a part of the alchemical process, the alchemist is holding a cauldron, and it begins to violently seethe, and vapors of moral ambiguity and everything fill the world, and the alchemist might drop the vessel, which would be a shame because it took a long time to get here. So what they have to do is reach up and invite in, this is kind of pertinent to us now, invite in whatever you want to say, Holy Ghost, spirit of trickster, you know, genius thing, you know, whatever, into the cauldron, and they do that, and then it begins to, the seething, you know, stops, and it begins to blend into liquid gold, and then we can have a wise culture cooperating with nature. So at the end of my presentation, I said, let's all do that. Let's all hold the cauldron in our mind's eye and invite in, you know, whatever is needed, you know, and it's very now, right? And everybody did that. It was like 800 people, like, and I ran into to Hillman, James Hillman, backstage, and I go, oh, you missed my lecture, and he goes, no, I liked it very much. I love astrology. I learned a lot, but that last thing you did, no, that's inflation. Anyway, so we did a, you know, a rough and tumble, and then the last time I saw him at Robert Bly's Great Mother Conference, we actually had a presentation on the stage, and he'd just written his book, which I found annoying, on how war is a necessary kind of a thing, you know. Anyway, I did say, let me be your Uranus return, which he was having right then, because the image for your Uranus, James, is, you know, a vision of peace. And he's like, oh, okay. And he liked being challenged, right? There were worshipful people around him who were like, oh no, somebody's, you know, arguing with daddy. But his little canines would show, dee-dee-dee. And just one last kind of confession. He did say archetypal psychology. And in my, delinquency, in my naive delinquency, I forgot that that was the name of everything he did. And I go, archetypal psychology, what an unfortunate pairing of words. You know, archetype used by Jung to smuggle living things into academia is a temporary thing, and as you know, astrology has more to contribute to psychology than the other way around. Anyway, his chelas were appalled, but he laughed. He liked it. He did like it. Anyway, so I just want to, yes, that to and fro. But so do you feel, in a way, the ancestral kinship? I mean, you worked with so many, we have so many buddies in common. But do you feel a sense of baton being passed to you to take the study and tease it into molecular experimentation and ritual?
Definitely. And when I found James, and I found him, I went looking for him because of something I read that he wrote. And then we wound up working together for like 15 years. But I was looking for a mentor who could bless something in myself that I could only barely recognize and make conscious. And to some degree, he did that. But in the area that we're talking about, which would be the active engagement with nature, with spirit in the moment, and I also think the kind of humble willingness to act like an elder at times, in those areas, he didn't have, you know, the solid ground under his own feet. And so I learned so much from James, and I also learned what I couldn't learn from him. And so, yeah, if we're going to talk about the baton, which being an instrument of magic can wind up here or there from time to time, and of course, as you know, no one owns it, but occasionally we have to pick up the baton. And then that's why I like the idea of genius. If we're aligned with our genius, or if you want to call it Carl Jung's deep self, or the soul, as James Hillman would call it, if we're aligned, then we can handle power in a way that is beneficial, healing, and generous. And that's, I think, the proper way to do it. And we may, I think we're in a collective rite of passage where we have to almost find our own way. In other words, like when you go back to the Buddha being in connected to nature and Buddha's own inner nature, which is a representation of our each inner nature, that if we can't feel our way to a genuine sense that there is something unique and valuable in us, then we either pick up the baton a la Trump and pretend to a power we can't handle, or out of an excessive humility and perhaps misunderstanding of someone like Buddha, we don't pick up the baton, and the world continues to careen, you know, in its misdirection.
Yes, these are all, everything you say is quite resonant and can take us off into, well, all stories lead us to all stories, but so there, it's like a tree, there's many branches, but all right, let's go over to this branch too, because I know you do a lot of work, you know, the resolution of conflict, which is important, and the resolution of conflict among stressed youth, and we do live in this recent upstart phase of humanity where the art of initiation has fallen by the wayside. There's people the likes of yourself. And let me toss this to you. I think that the essence, in a sense, of initiation is quite simple. It is to say, we need you. We need your unique qualities to build Stonehenge, to resolve, you know, global climate change, to contribute to the Renaissance. We need you. But it is that simple, you know, invitation. Here's the Venus part, you know, the invitation of we need you. And that's what's, you know, has been. We're all remedying that now, but lacking, because it's like, no, get lost, hang out at the mall, you know, go to prison, get in. No, we need the awakened imagination and genius of right-wing golfers, inner-city kids, you know, gangs, everything, right? I mean, does that make sense to you?
No, as a matter of fact, I'm not sure about right-wing golfers. having very limited experience, I would say, with them. But what happens, I think, so yeah, I've studied initiation since I was like 20 years old, and trying to understand how, you know, James Hillman would call it an archetype, right? The archetype of initiation. How could it return? Because it disappeared all around the world, even from tribal people. And that happens in the archetypal world. The wand gets waved, and what was on top goes to the bottom, and something else comes on top, whatever. But how do you bring it back legitimately? Because it's one thing to say we're going to go and initiate young people. It's another thing to figure out what it might really mean. And so I came to the point of going, okay, I don't want to be pretentious, and I don't want to risk building some foolish project that I then have to feel, you know, deeply anguished about. So I'm going to try and bring initiatory principles to places where the injury is so great that almost anything could help. And then I learned that people, when they're in the throes of their illness, when they're homeless, when they're lost in poverty, when they're caught, you know, all these young people that are doing drugs and being violent and whatever we're going to charge them with, they're all not part of the common culture. If you talk to them, they'll tell you, we're not part of it. And, of course, being not part of it is one of the steps of initiation. People have to get out of the mainstream in order to find the deeper stream. And so it turns out that it's actually easier to do initiatory work with people who are, so to speak, out of it.
Yes.
Than those who are in it. And so that became, for me, a kind of an honest way to work at initiation. But now I would say almost everybody's thrown into it. In other words, the problems have become so severe that the area of disturbance has become so great because of climate change, because of cultural collapse, that more and more people are available to initiatory experiences and initiatory awakenings.
Yes. And we're going to take a very short break in a moment. Absolutely in accord, because, again, we love words, right? So the word ecstatic means to stand outside. Mm-hmm. So I love people going, oh, I'm not invited, I'm an outsider. I go, that's because you have an ecstatic relationship to culture. And they're like, yeah, that's really great. And I did run across some quirky young women, good people, but awfully obedient, and I go, oh, they never rebelled against anything. Oh, what a terrible thing. Anyway, put a finger on these notes, because we want to come right back to them. More than perfect guest is Michael Mead. His website is mosaicvoices.org, and we'll be right back to announce his imminent Mill Valley appearances. We'll be right back after this very short break.
She shook the constellation that dazzled them crossed his eyes. She shook the constellation that dazzled them crossed his eyes. She showered his head with quasar and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Chanty, chanty, come blow my chanty home. Telegraph my indigo sky ship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. It is true Beltane tonight, the exact mid-season. Yeah, there's Halloween, there's Candlemas, there's Beltane and Lammas, cross-quarter holidays called the Four Gates of Power, where the quality, the intelligence of this season is especially eager to be invited in now. So this is kind of the Halloween of spring right now. And again, more than perfectly, we have astro-mytho fellow word maven Michael Mead. Again, his website is mosaicvoices.org. Wonderful podcast, very rich, incredibly prolific. And let's also remind people, or announce to people, that you will be in Mill Valley on Thursday, May 11th at 7 p.m. at Mount Tamalpais United Methodist Church in Mill Valley, and that people can get tickets at your website, yes?
Yes, mosaicvoices.org, yes.
Excellent. So this is answering the call of the soul in times of trouble and disorder. Excellent. Do you want to say any little more about that?
Well, you know, if we go back to James Hillman, one of the great things about Hillman was he was a highly educated Western person coming from philosophy and psychology and academia, and saying the soul is the main thing, that the soul provides meaning. He was echoing the hidden wisdom, ancient Western tradition. So one of the things I'm saying with an event like that is that rather than collapse in the face of the political disasters, as you said, following the wrong star, turn and listen to the call of the soul. I think we're in trouble for a considerable period now, just because of the tremendous coincidence of disturbances in nature and collapse going on in culture. And so if we can't trust things on the outside, then we have to turn to the inside. But many modern people think they're empty inside. That's what we've been educated to believe. And so I try to talk about the soul. And the call of the soul, secretly trying to call us to become our authentic self. And then in the next step, soul is required for community. There cannot be any unity amongst people unless the soul is present. And so the evening is stories about that and perhaps a little side mythological view of someone like Donald Trump.
Oh, yeah. No, that's great. No, because it is a horrific cartoon in which the devolutionary worst aspect of our species has been, the triumphant of malignant narcissism and sociopathy and access to power. You can check it out on Wikipedia. It's the demonic triad. And we go, yeah, we've really done it now. But so when this happened, well, I loved also hearing Michael Moore the other night, and he's getting more and more himself in a great way, more and more trickster, dedicated, but still jaunty. And he said, since he realized this train wreck was coming last August, and so did I, because I was actually at the Republican convention going, oh my God, we're getting smoked on our strong suit of story. We've allowed story to be kidnapped by the con man, and we want to bring it back to the trickster. But Michael Moore said, since he realized the train wreck was coming, he says he's been on a creative tear. Right, and he's about to do a Broadway show, and Lawrence O'Donnell was like, "Isn't that kind of elitist?" And Michael Moore was, "Well, I want to go back to talking to the right wing golfers in a way," but he said, "No, I want to cross bridges, right? I want to go where everybody is, and Middle America hangs out there, so I'm going wherever anybody is, to inner cities and Broadway and everything." But I like that turning the trauma. I've been at so many groups where people were talking about their trauma, my trauma, my trauma. Some of them even forgot what it was, but they knew they had one, right? And I said, how about next time tempted to use the word trauma, just let's use the phrase my dangerous, beautiful assignment. Right? And some people were resistant at first, but then they came back the next day and said, that was really interesting. Yeah. Because it's what you're talking about, which is that whatever we've undergone, it's not for whaley-whaley, it's to brew medicine from that experience and redeem it by doing so for oneself and the world. So I like our dangerous, beautiful assignment because that's, again, the initiation. We all have a dangerous, beautiful assignment and something unique to brew, in the bubbling cauldron, So, and then to invite in the little missing ingredient to that dynamic. But so that's your Thursday, May 11th. I will be telepathically attending for sure if I were in the Bay Area, which I will be in June. But if I were there, I would definitely attend. And it's so delightful to reconnect with you. I hosted you on the radio, 10 years ago or something. But I think, we are being scheduled by some genius. Because then after May 11th, then on May 13th, on Saturday, from 9:30 to 5:30 at the Community Church of Mill Valley, you are doing Agents of Creation, Healing and Renewal in Chaotic Times. And any way you want to pitch that. Introduction to Create a Ritual. There we go.
Well, what I'm wanting to do there is address two things that are not that well understood typically. First of all, myth, which modern people tend to think means, it's just a myth, it's something false, but ancient people used to mean emergent truth. And so an emergency, let's say like our current climate emergency or our political emergency, actually suggests that something's trying to emerge. And I think one of the things would be the return of mythic imagination. From a certain point of view, you could say the world has become flat again because everybody is connected but horizontally, and we've lost the vertical imagination that you're always talking about that ties us through astrology and through dreams to the stars. And so bringing back mythic perspective brings back the stars as we started to talk about at the beginning, but it also brings back the deep core of the earth, which is also part of our heritage. And then, as we've already touched on, the big missing ingredient in many ways is ritual. This would be a crossing day, a quarter day, and a ritual day, and people would pass between two fires, for instance, would be one of the old traditions, in order to purge and cleanse and step into the next phase or the next season, kind of born anew out of fire. But they would also go to the holy wells, and they knew what to do when they got there. And I don't think we're going to get through this without learning to reconnect with each other, regardless of differences, through ritual. And, that was what the Celts were doing. on a, every, you know, four times a year at least, you had to all come together. They would put out, like on Beltane, they would put out all the fires in all the hearths of all the houses and all the common spaces, and the whole world would go dark, and then they would light one fire, and then take the flame from that fire and run. This is on Ireland, which wasn't that big a place. And people would take that flame and run from village to village until all of the hearths were relit from the same fire, from the same flame. That one fire that was kept burning when all the others went out. That was the way people got unified. Yes, they all had differences. For God's sake, they were Irish. They'd fight about anything. But on certain times of the year, they were all together. And I think that's what we're going to have to find. I'm all for good protest. I grew up in the protests of the 60s, but protests often don't go quite far enough when we need to find ways of soulfully being connected and ways to spiritually be awake together. And so the workshop is partly about mythic imagination and partly about the return of ritual.
Perfect. Putting all fires out, the whole world goes dark. All, you know, the Mesoamerica did this as well. It's really great. And it's like, again, for, bonfires, dedicated sacred bonfires, or arson. Or arson, take your pick, because Beltane has been, Cinco de Mayo, huge riots, many riots, break out because bonfires are arson. There you take your pick. So I love that, and I also love what Standing Rock and many have contributed to us, which is the evolution of the word protester to protector, because the word protest comes from testes, it means to affirm by grabbing your balls. That's what the word comes from, Leviticus. Protector, so much more wonderful. But yeah, as you say about the Irish, is this a private fight, or can anybody join in?
Just to say, though, the grabbing of the balls was a way to get men to understand vulnerability.
Yeah, that's true.
That was a Hermes move.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when people made a deal, this is ancient Greece. Well, you probably know. Right. And in ancient Greece, you had to touch each other's, when two men made a deal, they had to touch each other's balls. They had to attest from their testes,
Which
was a place of vulnerability. And this is what these pretend deal makers in Washington don't understand. Every deal is vulnerable.
Right. No, I love that. This adds to the compost I've been collecting. But because I go that, well, that's why women can't testify or protest, but we can ovify, right? So I'm all in favor of everybody ovifying. So that's wonderful. So yeah, the bonfire.
Well, and vulnerability comes from vulva. So.
Does it? Does it really? Because
I'm not sure. That's what we call Irish etymology.
Because it means woundable. I try to not use it when people say, we want to become vulnerable. Love makes you vulnerable. I'm like, no, obsession and toxic flirtation make you vulnerable. Love makes you stronger, because it does mean woundable. It's a battlefield world. But I'll have to check, actually.
Yeah, I'll have to go check too. That jumped into my mind.
No, I mean that would be interesting. We know that Inanna, Venus, recently returned as the morning star, and the Inanna myth, which was the Venus orbital cycle. It's a whole realm we can go that ancient people stashed their scientific knowledge in myth and folktale and folk tales to hand on. So the Inanna myth is the Venus orbital cycle. It's really brilliant. But when Inanna Venus gets back from the underworld, as she is now, it says, she goes, that was really intense. Okay. And then it says one day she's contemplating the wonders of her own vulva, and the idea occurs to her, like, whoa, the genius strikes, and she goes, I know, I'm going to rescue human culture. And human culture has been stolen by Enki, the god of wisdom, who's become a tyrant, reminding us that anybody unchallenged will become tyrannical. And that's her overland adventure. But that's kind of fun. Yes, but I'm not sure about Irish etymology. That's very fun. But let's homage also just a little bit to the Celts too, who thought that satire was the most effective fashion of bringing down the unruly tyrant. Right, and so that's why Michael Moore was going, satire, satire, Trumpelstiltskin is so thin-skinned, you know, satire, satire. No, but at the same time, it's story crafting. You know, the story crafting, I think, is really crucial because that's where the team of good-hearted beings, we let ourselves get smoked. And that's what I realized, you know, in August at the... in Cleveland at the Republican convention, going, oh, the con man has stolen story, and Hillary has no story craft, except, you know, and so, but it behooves all of us, again, those dedicated to story craft, the likes of yourself, and quickening within all of our dedicated, beautiful listeners, you know, to have the invitational story, you know, come, we need you. I'm sticking in the right wing golfers too, because you know, like Michael Moore, because as the razzle dazzle swindle becomes apparent, and even this horrible, you know, healthcare depriving people, which a number of people are like, oh, and remember the eclipse on August 21st, which brings down tyrants. But anyway, as the razzle dazzle swindle becomes apparent, there's a whole lot of people looking for a story. Trump provided them a toxic mimic story. Bernie had a pretty authentic story. You know, everybody wants to know how they're being snookered and bamboozled. And Trump said, you're being bamboozled by those people, scapegoats, you know. And Bernie said, we're being bamboozled, and here's what we're going to do about it. But it's like, come on over. You know, come on over. You know, the restoration of human culture, like Inanna Venus did, you know, and then, you know, come on over. We need everybody. See, the trickster redeemer doesn't count on the softening of the tyrant's heart, but they're willing to have it be in play. You know, and it is part of the Venusian contribution that whatever we speak to in another is the part of them we're inviting to dance with the corresponding part of ourselves. Hmm. And I know this works. I know this works because I, on your behalf, you know, and my listeners know this too, I've gone to CPAC, all right? I've gone to the lowest forms of hell, you know, the gatherings of the conservatives. I stood next to Andrew Breitbart's, you know, weeks before he died. I've been in the realm of deep toxicity. But there's always an ally somewhere. There is, awaiting invitation. Because there's mystery. You don't know. And I love Perry Henzel's great novel, Power Game, he who wrote The Harder They Come. And in it, he delineates, if you're in Jamaica and you want the democratic revolution, you need a very broad team. You want the Rastas smoking the ganja. You want a scientist. You want some ally in the State Department who's going to call off the invasion. You want some troubled conscience investment banker guy over there who's going to funnel, you know, I mean, you want a broad thing. So I'm in favor of going, you know, everybody, whoever, heeding the call, that it's dire enough that people want to be invited. But that's great. So anyway, so you're going to be meeting with Agents of Creation Workshop, wonderful Saturday, May 13th, 9:30 to 5:30 p.m. Those who feel resonant, you can sign up for Michael Mead's. Do you call it a workshop? I guess workshop. I'm replacing workshop with councils myself. I'm just always playing with words. But then also awakening the call.
Well, the truth is, it's a ritual. So, in other words, people come together looking for something. Anybody in the ancient world would say, oh, what's the ritual? People go looking for knowledge, and someone says, oh, you know, you're in a class. But looking for knowledge in from the soul's point of view would be the beginning of a ritual. Or, like I remember one of the Aboriginal elders, David Maljuli, was in the States. He was brilliant, and he got somewhere, and they said, okay, well, we'd like you to give your lecture now. And he said, oh, no, I come from the ancient people. We don't lecture. I'll try to find a story, and then we'll be in it together, and that makes it a ritual. And so in a sense, it's a ritual shop, or it's a ritual work, or it's really a little bit, you know, an attempt at teaching, but it's also a gathering to honor, to find the threads of, and find a greater connection to the ritual imagination, as well as, like you're saying, the story crafting, which is, you know, finding enough narratives that keeps including more and more people.
Right. Right. And also, just checking your Irish etymology. No, vulnerable does not come from vulva. Thank goodness for that. Okay, all right. I know it's
wounded. Well, wait a minute. I want to make the argument for vulnerability. All right. We love the weakness in each other. In other words, when we fall in love, we fall in love with everything in the other person, but off. A main thing in the other person is the weakness, some kind of weakness, some kind of fallibility that allows us in. And so at least I imagine being vulnerable. Well, I also think of the soul as vulnerable. That's why Well, that's why it's so easily rejected. So, all right. So then what's your argument with vulnerability?
That it's just as an experimental, you know, we are all concerned citizens for throwing tired language into the cauldrons where it can be whatever. We do want to know what we're saying, and it is wounding, and it first arrives as battle talk, right? It arrives from war. So I'm concerned citizens for just even for one day having a war metaphor fast, just for the fun of it, like because you know we're going to fight for this, we're going to fight for that, we're going to fight, you know, stand up, sit down, fight. But fight's a very hot word. It's completely Mars with no Venus, and they know that when we use it, even when it's fight for something good, it downloads a whole cascade of kind of adrenaline in our psyches because our brains are mythic. And I know it's impossible. I mean, Bill McKibben, he's fighting for, God love him, he's, you know, whatever. He can do whatever he wants. And I know it would be a little awkward for Bernie and Bill McKibben to go, we're going to dance for peace. But I think expanding the word. So it's like somebody said, you know, the dark night of the soul. I like challenging everything. And they said, the soul doesn't have a dark night. The personality has a dark night.
No. Wait. Remember? Soul means the light found in the darkness.
Yes.
So that the soul is constantly calling us into a dark night of the soul. And we live in a world made of darkness and light. So back to the idea that wisdom is not being brighter than other people. Wisdom means knowing darkness and knowing light. I don't know. That's at least where I would go with it.
No. I think that's great. No, I think I can find where we're in accord on this one.
I
think, you know, going, okay. Yes, a dark night of the soul, we would wish that for everyone, right?
Well, yeah, those on top, insisting that they never fail and insisting that they know the right way to go, have not either lived or acknowledged the dark night of their own soul. If they did, they wouldn't have so much arrogance or pretension, I would say.
Yep, that's good too. And then also see the dark night of the soul from your honoring, a dark night of the soul would be a blessing to the soul. The soul wants a dark night.
Yes.
Right? And it's just that how it's degraded in the vernacular, going, oh man, I had a dark night of the soul last night.
Oh, I see what you mean.
But that's great. No, I think we've redeemed it, going, yes, a dark night of the soul. May everybody have a dark night of the soul. What a wonderful thing. Yes, deep,
like
absolutely.
And the moment when they put all the fires out.
Then yes, that's great.
Everybody's in the same dark night, and then the light comes back, and everybody realizes, oh, we are actually the scintilla flames of that light being relit, just as our hearts are now being relit. That was the ritual of everybody being in the darkness, and then everybody bringing back the light, and then realizing we're all burning from the same flame.
That's great. Yeah, and then I also like just to add to the ritual realm, because people have become averse to being kind of told what to do, stand on your left foot, and then, anyway. But I like to, as a starter kit, going, a ritual is any physical thing we do that we imbue with dedicated symbolism. So we can sweep the floor, or we can sweep the past out as we sweep the floor. We can stir the soup, or we can invoke blessings into the soup. You know, again, you just, why fool around? And this is such a great time now of every small gesture. You know, let's all sit with our backs against a tree, you know, and hum, you know, which hums our, you know, alhamdulillah, you know, which is our throat, which is the Taurus area, going, yeah, by sitting by this tree, you know, may world peace waft out into the, whatever. So ritual, I think, you know, does always contain a seed within it of a blessing for the collective. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. In ritual, genuine ritual, we find ourselves feeling connected to everything, included the unseen beings and the trees that we're leaning against or trying to protect. That's part of the purpose of almost any ritual, is to say that we are secretly connected to the center of all things, and we are just a unique manifestation of that center. Because in ritual, you're really supposed to awaken to the two things. The thing we're all connected to, the way we're making the song or the dance together, and then the unique part of it that is my own soul, my own self. So I agree completely.
No, that's great. And I think it's also, you know, this the Mars and Venus dance. You know, Venus magnetizes and invites, and Mars animates, and then together they spiral it out into the world. You know, it's said that the essence of ritual magic was to spiral expanded wisdom and tolerance into group mind. And I go, I love that. So forming now this festival of animism that we're in right now, where, you know, nature and everything backstage is so eager for humans to rejoin, you know, to form a partnership, you know, whatever we love, you know, become like it to protect it, become like wolves to protect wolves, become like water. So I love that dynamic. We're in our final moments. But let's think of this as part one, because this is really fun. This is like dedicated fun. But I didn't know the etymology of hypocrite. I love that. Can
Isn't
you
that
just
good?
Give us... Yeah, it's really good. Give us the etymology of hypocrite.
Okay, origins of theater in ancient Greece, and the main players in a given theatrical piece would be called the protagonist, the one who agonizes the most, proto-agonist. And so they would stand in the center of the stage and live out the agony, the ecstasy, and the tragedy of humanity for everyone to remember what it was. And then the secondary actors, the bit players, would be called the hypocrites.
Adorable.
And so then the recent essay I wrote was to say the mistake recently made in America was to elect a hypocrite to play the role of a protagonist. And as soon as people realize it, they can walk out of the play and find another story.
No, that's really great. No, we're on our way out. But again, it behooves all of us to join hands with Michael Mead and the likes of ourselves, and to go attend his fantastic workshop. You can or convocation and lecture. You can find out at mosaicvoices.org. Because we all want to, the hypocrite, and then to invite to a larger story. We're all story crafting beings. Anyway, thank you so much, Michael Mead. This was deep, dedicated fun.
Thank you, Caroline. I agree. Great fun.
Great fun. And thanks very much to Erica Bridgman in KPFA land. And I'm coming to you with coyote hair around me from the Coyote Witchery in Washington, D.C. And we will reconvene next week with, again, Critique and Solutions. Thanks again, Michael Mead. Yay.
Thank you, Carolyn. Be well.
Be well.
Miguel Gavilan Molina, inviting you to join us for a special day of programming celebrating the legacy of Cinco de Mayo. The 5th of May is a date of great importance for the Chicano Mexican communities. The day commemorates a military victory on May 5, 1862. The Mexican people fought fiercely and won the Battle of Puebla against a highly trained and sophisticated regiment of 20,000 professional French soldiers. The significance of the 5th of May today commemorates a development developing nations' resistance to the lending policies of wealthier nations. The 5th of May symbolizes the emergence of a national Latino identity forged through immigration, blood, sweat, and tears, a time for the advancement of the greater society with vibrant influences of cultural diversity and spiritual enrichment. Mexicatawi, aho.
South Bay Contra invites you to our monthly Contra Dance, featuring the live fiddle tunes of Switching Protocols and Calling by Mavis McGaw. The Contra Dance takes place from 3 to 6 p.m. on Sunday, May 21st, at First Unitarian Church of San Jose, 160 North 3rd Street. No experience or partner needed, and all ages are welcome. This event is wheelchair accessible and is a benefit for Bay Area Country Dance Society and First Unitarian Church of San Jose. For more information, call 408-341-9123. That's 408-341-9123.